Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for May 2009. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. This month's podcast has a foreign twist. My first guest is the Right Honorable Sir Robin Jacob, a judge of the Court of Appeal of England and Wales. I'll be asking him about the submissions he made to the European Commission Pharma Sector Inquiry regarding competition in the pharmaceutical industry. My second guest is Bela Celedonia, a trademark lawyer and partner with the Cowan, Leibowitz & Latman firm in New York City. I'll be asking her about the right way and the wrong way for foreign trademark owners to apply for U.S. intention to use trademark registrations based on a foreign registration. The Right Honorable Sir Robin Jacob is in charge of the intellectual property list of the Court of Appeal of England and Wales. Sir Robin has a special perspective on intellectual property law. While in private practice as a barrister, Sir Robin tried many intellectual property cases and, since becoming a judge in 1993, has decided many more. The pharmaceutical sector in Europe has recently come under the scrutiny of the European Commission, which is looking into the industry for anti-competitive behavior. Sir Robin Jacob recently wrote a paper critical of the Commission's preliminary results and its approach to patent law, and presented a paper at the Fordham Conference in March 2009, equally critical. Sir Robin joins me from his chambers in London. Good afternoon, Sir Robin.
Good afternoon.
You wrote a paper recently and presented at the Fordham Conference in March 2009 about the European Commission Pharma Sector Inquiry. What's the nature of that inquiry?
Well, it's an inquiry which was started by the Commission on its own, and the reasons it gave were the only reasons I know for it, which was one, that they weren't finding enough, and the pharma companies weren't finding enough new drugs, and that there was evidence that generic competition wasn't entering soon enough. I was asked by the Commission to go to Brussels when they presented their preliminary findings. They gave the executive overview to me, but not the detailed report, just before I got there, the day before, and I gave the speech which I annexed to my Fordham speech, and that's how I got into it. So I came in, I'm commenting because the Commission asked me to, really.
In the paper you wrote and the comment you made at Fordham University, or at the Fordham Conference, you indicated that it appeared that the Competition Directorate didn't really understand how the patent system works. Could you explain what you were describing there?
Well, there were a number of aspects in which they plainly sort of had views which didn't fit with reality. For example, they worry about follow-on patents. Well, they may be good, they may be bad, but all patents have to satisfy the same criteria. They've got to be novel and non-obvious. The fact that some people apply for patents which turn out to be no good has been a feature of the patent system since it began. And to discover that this is suddenly happening in the pharma field is not making a discovery at all. Likewise, it's been possible under the European system, I think rather irrationally, to make divisional applications even when the patent office don't require it. And that can complicate things, and doubtless some patentees in all fields do that for that purpose, or for other more legitimate purposes, like, well, this bit there's no argument over, so I'll get this bit done and argue with the patent office over the next bit. To that extent, it's being cleared up to some extent by the proposed changes in the rules of the patent office, which have been brought in by Alison Brimelow. But to see this as some sort of giant anti-competitive operation seems to me to be quite misplaced. Again, the Commission don't understand that a lot of patent actions are lost by patentees, not just in pharma cases, but generally. And that's not a very surprising phenomenon, because in all ways the plaintiff has got more to gain if he wins than the defendant has if he wins. So a lot of the sort of basic realities of the system seem to be missing in the pharma, in the Commission's inquiry. To some extent, I wondered about that, as to why. I know they had an official from the Patent Office, an examiner, assisting them, but I'm being blunt about it. Patent examiners are not the people who know how the patent system works. It's not their job to know it.
It appears that the commission was suspicious in that the number of really important drugs coming forward seemed to be diminishing and saw something sinister in that. What explanation do you have that...
I don't have an explanation. I can offer a number of possible explanations. One is it's just hard being harder to find them. Two is that the regulatory requirements mean that too many fall by the wayside on the way. Three... It is a worry, even if they get irrespective regulatory requirements, that the litigation in the United States has become so oppressive that drug companies are themselves being more conservative in what they're prepared to try and bring to market. And if one thinks of the Vioxx disaster, there's many a person with arthritis who'd be quite willing to accept a doubled risk of heart attack to have the relief that Vioxx used to give. So if you look at all sorts of things, the answer is you don't know. One thing the commission never looked into was the science, and to see whether there was any scientific reason why people aren't finding any more things.
One of the subjects raised by the commission was that they should grant all good patents and refuse all bad ones. In your paper, you said, in truth, a patent office is kind of a coarse filter, rejecting clearly bad cases, but having to allow those which may be good. I see in your report you thought that a responsive court would be the solution to dealing with bad patents.
Yes, I mean, that is the solution which works in my country. Because our courts work fast, and particularly in the pharma field, where by and large money is no object, because the sums of money involved in the market are much bigger than the sums involved in litigation. We have a system where pharma companies know that their patents are likely to be attacked very quickly if they're no good. And for what it's worth, about 5 or 6 years back, there was I gave an interlocutory decision at first instance, and the Court of Appeal approved it, saying, look, if a generic company wants to come on the market, it must know what patents there are out there, and all it's got to do is to knock them out if it thinks they're no good. And indeed, that's what generic companies have been doing, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. And not just generic companies, other companies too, in other fields.
You indicate in your speech as well that you saw an indication in the preliminary report that minor improvement should not be patentable.
Yes, there was a sort of tendency there saying, well, minor improvements somehow shouldn't be patentable, only big inventions count. Well, that's not the way the patent world works. The test is it novel or not, and non-obvious, not whether it's a minor improvement or not.
One of the aspects they dealt with, and perhaps you've discussed this already, is the concept of evergreening. And in your paper, you refer to the fact that evergreening occurs not only in the drug industry, but in virtually every industry as a company tries to perpetuate its business.
Yeah, well, that's the way the patent system works, for medicine or onwards. I mean, there's nothing special about the pharma industry in this. It is true there have been some examples of extremely greedy patents, which frankly ought not to have been granted, ought not to have been applied for. I have in mind the Servier case. Well, I can't say you can blame the patent office because they couldn't tell. But Servier must have known that patent was no good. And they applied for it. Whether there should be a remedy for somebody who applies for an intellectual property right which he knows is no good is a separate and different question, but it's nothing to do with the pharma industry in particular. And in my own experience of the illegitimate assertion of the existence or infringement of intellectual property rights is much greater outside the field of pharma and is more pernicious outside the field of pharma when it's big companies against very little guys who always back off. So this is a much more general, interesting question in its own way, but it's got very little to do with the pharma industry.
One of the suggested changes to the law that the report deals with is... having a positive obligation on the inventor to disclose all information material to patentability. I understand that's never been the law in England, is that right?
Yes. That is quite correct, and we've never had the patentee has never had to disclose the prior art known to him. It has become something of a law in the United States, but truth is, if you bring in such a law, then you have a bigger litigation about what did the man know and what should he and what is it when he said he didn't know? Do you have discovery about it, which is quite alien to the continental concept of litigation? Then you have an argument what he should have known, and I don't think you get anything. If there's a knockout on the patent, the best thing to do is to knock the patent out. It's the shortest and sharpest remedy.
One point that you approve of from the report is the recommendation for a central European patent court. You say, one thing is clear, the need for a strong and fast central patent court for Europe sticks out like a mile.
Yes. And not just something from the Pharma report, but quite generally. It is perfectly ridiculous to get different results in different European countries, sometimes on different evidence. We've just had that in where the English court upheld a patent, the Lundbeck patent, and the Dutch court, dealing with the same point but on different evidence, said no, it was no good. And it's perfectly ridiculous for Europe, which has got a common market, to go on with, as though it hasn't got, in effect, a common patent system. And so we need to create such a court. It's a very difficult task. It's been a task older than the European Union itself. There are language difficulties. There are problems with the concept of a national jurisdiction being infringed by some sort of European thing. But it's the only way forward. And I'm glad to say the European Commission in a different department is indeed pressing hard as it possibly can on doing that. I wish it had a bit more resources granted to it.
You issue some warnings in your paper about meddling with the patent system. At one point you say it's the patent system which has made the advances in medicine possible. Without a reliable patent monopoly, there's simply no incentive to invest, and you make reference to the fact that there have been no big drugs coming out of the USSR. And you say if you damage the income stream of research companies, you're going to imperil future research at the expense of European, indeed, world citizens.
Yeah, well, 2 points there. One is the European Commission treat this as though it's a solely European problem, which is almost perverse given the fact that the big pharma industry is worldwide. And secondly, it's self-evident. I mean, the companies spend their money as when it comes in on research. And if they haven't got any money coming in, they have less to spend on research. True it is they pay dividends and other things too, but nobody's suggesting the dividends being paid out are ridiculous. So what are you going to do? Reduce the dividends, reduce the research. It's a simple equation. And this is all for the sake of giving a bit of money to the generic companies who do no research or no relevant research. I find the thing fantastic. Particularly, and I would add, that the customers, who are the real customers in this field, are big customers. So it's not the normal thing you have in competition law where you've got the competition authorities protecting, in effect, Joe Public, little guys, from the predatory behavior of big, powerful companies. Here, the customers, in most cases, are as big as or bigger than the drug companies. They are the national governments or the giant insurance companies.
All right. Thank you, Sir Robin.
Okay. Good night.
If you are a foreign owner of a registered trademark, you can use that as a basis for an intended use application in the United States. But be careful how you apply. Do it wrong, and you could lose your application. The U.S. Trademark Trial and Appeal Board rendered a decision in April this year that gives guidance on how not to file an intention to use trademark application in the United States based on a foreign registration. Bela Celedonia is a partner with a New York firm of Cowan, Leibowitz, and Latman. One of her areas of expertise is in the area of administering domestic and international trademark registration programs. She's recognized as one of the world's leading trademark practitioners and one of the best lawyers in America. Bela spoke with me from her office in New York City. Good afternoon, Bela.
Good afternoon to you.
You've written a case comment on the Honda Motor Company versus Friedrich Winckelmann case and entitled it A Trap for the Unwary Non-U.S. Applicant. What was the trap in that case?
Well, the trap is that because U.S. practice is different, that non-U.S. Applicants don't realize that the law that says you need a bona fide intention to use a mark that you're applying for really means that you have to have a bona fide intention to use the mark for the goods and services that you've listed. And that's whether you're applying under intent to use, whether you're applying through Madrid, or if you're applying based on a foreign registration or application.
And who are the parties involved in this particular case?
The opposer was Honda Motors, and they were objecting to an application by Friedrich Winkelmann of the mark VIC based on their Civic mark.
And what had Winkelmann done to show his intent to use the mark in the United States?
Well, by way of that procedural background, because the United States also, unlike most places in the world, have discovery even in proceedings before the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board, which is dealing with registration matters. The opposition was originally based on likelihood of confusion with the Civic mark, but in response to interrogatories, Winkelmann really gave almost nothing with response to the question of showing bona fide intention to use the mark in the United States, what plans or what else they had. And then Honda filed a motion to dismiss the opposition based on the fact that there was no likelihood, there was no bona fide intention to use the mark. What Winkelmann filed then as the in defense of that motion was an unsubstantiated declaration that, yes, they intended to use the mark, that in additional evidence of their bona fide intention to use the mark was the fact that they've done these various filings in various different countries, and their website, which the court points out they didn't bother to translate.
It seems that there was some evidence of use of the VIC mark in association with wares, a gift box or something to be used in connection with an automobile dealership, but the application was for intention to use with respect to a vehicle for transportation. How critical was not having evidence of vehicle use to his application?
It was absolutely critical. There was absolutely no evidence that Winkelmann used or intended to use the VIC mark for automobiles. And in fact, if you the application was even broader and sort of a typical thing that you see, it's vehicles for transportation on land, air, water, namely motor-propelled and self-propelled vehicles for use on land and on water, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, from the website, it was obvious that Winkelmann was not in the business of manufacturing vehicles, that it was in the business of creating these sort of vehicle accessories and such as this gift item which appeared on their website. But the court in effect specifically said there's no evidence that they make vehicles of any kind anywhere in the world.
So what does a proper United States intention to use application require when it's based on a foreign registration?
Well, from what I've seen in this particular case, they could not have based a U.S. application on their foreign registration because it wasn't covering the goods that they were intending to use the mark on. I don't know what other registrations, if any, they had in Europe that they could have used as a basis, but they couldn't have used that one. Now, you can use a foreign registration, and following foreign practice, you'll see a whole laundry list very often of goods and services that you can and do put in non-U.S. applications. I recommend that the applicant look over that list and cross out those things that they have no intention of ever using the mark on. For example, very often when you're in Class 16, which is paper goods, and the client is doing a magazine about social issues, you will see something that says paper. I mean, they're not planning to sell paper. They're never planning to sell paper. That should be just crossed out. Then you can be as broad as whatever is in the foreign application, and the U.S. Trademark Office will make you narrow it down and be specific. But if the suggestion of the examiner is something that you're never going to do, even though it fits in the broad category, you don't accept what the examiner says. You are specific about what you're planning to use the mark for.
Does that intention to use have to be documented in any way, shape, or form, or can the Trademarks Office look at past conduct, past foreign conduct?
Well, it is always best if you have documentary evidence of your bona fide intention to use a business plan, etc. But it's not absolutely necessary, and I think for non-U.S. applicants, let's say you've come up with a new mark and you're planning to launch it in your home country, Canada, and you've got the documentary evidence about what you're doing to launch a brand, and there has to be, if you're really going to launch a brand, what you're doing. And you don't need anything in writing that you're planning to then go into the United States if that's your usual practice, to go into the United States. But at a minimum, you are going to need documentary evidence of some kind that you're going to use the mark in your home country.
Do you think overstating the statement of wares or services would have a detrimental effect on other wares and services in the application where there really was a bona fide intention to use them on those other wares and services?
Well, you know, the interesting question is all the cases so far that deal with bona fide intention to use, which have dismissed or rejected an application, a pending application, for lack of a bona fide intention to use. And they're the previous cases were all with U.S. applicants. There was no bona fide intention to use the mark for any of the goods and services. So what there isn't is a case where there was an intention on one or two of the goods, but not on the rest. And so it's difficult to say how it would come out. Would they throw out the entire application, which would lose you your priority date on those things that you really do have a bona fide intention to use? I wouldn't want to be the test case. And there's really no advantage in the United States for being over-expansive. One thing I think that a lot of non-Americans don't realize is that even when you have this registration based on your home country registration, you can't enforce it in a court of law, you know, i.e. sue someone for trademark infringement, unless you've actually used the mark in the United States. That your registration just gives you procedural advantages and certain presumptions, but your trademark rights in the United States come from your use of the mark. So you're sitting there, and it, yes, you have a registration, but until you've actually used the mark in the United States for specific goods, you can't enforce that registration. And then you'll only be able to enforce it to the extent of those goods or similar goods that are, you know, likely to cause confusion. So if you're a clothing fashion designer and someone uses your mark for perfumes, and that's a normal area of expansion, you may be able to stop that even if you haven't begun your own perfume line yet. But there's no advantage and there's risk to being overexpansive in your list of goods.
And as you say, who wants to be the first test case?
Absolutely. Especially in the United States, where it's very expensive to be involved in any kind of litigation, even in the trademark office, in the Trademark Trial and Appeal Board, which has recently changed its rules and made it much more like a regular court litigation, other than the fact that there's no live testimony. So it is expensive to litigate here, and the more you can avoid it or cut out issues, the better.
Thank you very much, Bela.
It was my pleasure.
My guests for this podcast have been the Right Honorable Sir Robin Jacob, a judge of the Court of Appeal of England and Wales, and Bela Celedonia, a partner in the Cowan, Leibowitz & Latman firm in New York City. For a copy of Sir Robin Jacob's submissions to the European Commission Pharma Sector Inquiry and the paper he delivered at the Fordham Conference in March 2009, and for a copy of Bela Celedonia's paper on A Trap for the Unwary Non-U.S. Applicant, and for information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International IP Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.